I'm Sarah Schwartz-Sachs, and this is the Jamaica Plain Forum podcast, with community conversations on the great issues of the day. Visit us online at www.jamaicaplainforum.org to find out about upcoming events. And subscribe to our podcast to take us with you everywhere you go. The Jamaica Plain Forum is a program of the First Church in Jamaica Plain Unitarian Universalist and the Institute for Policy Studies. Podcast recorded and produced by David Goodman of the Independent Broadcast Information Service, ibisradio.org. Technical support for this podcast comes from the folks at quilted.org.
Justice, and let me turn it to our program. Tonight we are thrilled to have with us Kim Fellner, and I've known Kim for quite a while. I first knew of Kim when she was an organizer with the National Writers Union, and then she's been a longtime labor movement activist, helped start something called the National Organizers Alliance, which was kind of like an association, a union really, for people who do community organizing. And I actually have a pension thanks to the National Organizers Alliance, so I'm very thankful. And someday in my old age, I'll probably have a little picture of Kim on my altar, keeping, you know, with my pension check. Hopefully it didn't, won't all go away. So that's how I know Kim. And a couple years ago, she was inspired, and she'll say more about this, to write a book about Starbucks. And she has took some time to really look at issues, the role of Starbucks in the economy as a coffee shop. I mean, just curious, how many of you are coffee drinkers? Okay, how many of you don't drink coffee? So most people in the room though probably rely on some form of coffee. How many of you have had a Starbucks in the last 2 months? Okay. So this is a great, I'm glad you came out because I think this is a great opportunity to learn more about this company. Kim's book, what I love about it is a real journey, a real exploration. She had some ideas going into it, but she was really open to learning about this company. And so we're thrilled that Kim is with us. She's going to talk for a while. She asked to sort of sit down. We have a little podium here. She said, I'd just like to sit and talk and have a conversation. So well, we hope that she'll talk for a little while and then we'll have a conversation. And then we also have her book here for sale. And we have a discounted sale for $20. You can buy her new book, Wrestling with Starbucks. There it is. So let's give Kim Fellner a Jamaica Plain welcome all the way from Washington, D.C. Sound, and that's recording over there.
This is very hard for someone who talks with her hands. I'm sort of feeling, I'm going to knock these over, but I hope I don't. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really so excited to be here.
People here back there?
I've had friends from Jamaica Plain for...
You need to kind of eat the mic just a little bit, sorry.
Oh, too bad about that. So I've had friends from Jamaica Plain for a long time, and I'm very glad to finally get to be here. And I thought maybe tonight, I would talk a little bit about actually doing the research for this book as a way to get into some of the issues. What I found is that really everybody has an opinion, and that was one way that doing the research for the book was easy. I'm going to start by reading just the first paragraph of the book, which really lays out what this is about. It was November 30th, 1999. I was standing amid a horde of demonstrators at what was about to be dubbed the Battle of Seattle, the protest against the World Trade Organization that hurled global justice into the headlines and gave new meaning to our macchiatos. Suddenly, there was a crash not 20 feet from where I stood, and the Starbucks window collapsed in a hail of glass. Hey, I said to my husband, Alec, that's our coffee store. Right there, on a cool November day, near the intersection of 5th and Pine in downtown Seattle, our parallel universes, as consumers, global justice activists, and union members collided. The global economy had come home to roost, and apparently to roast. And that sort of sets what this book is about. This book really uses Starbucks as a lens to look at how we practice and define our values in the global economy. And in order to do this, you know, I've spent my entire life really as a union and social justice activist. And most of my relationship to corporations has been to fight them in one form or another. And that's really what I've done. I'm one of those people who managed to live from the 60s to 60, doing work that I love. But when I was standing out there on that street in Seattle, and I was there as part of a labor delegation, something about that situation just started to make me itch. And, you know, I kind of looked around. I started talking with my friends a little bit. And it turned out that there was sort of this huge ambivalence. Here we were fighting global tyrants and out protesting the World Trade Organization and yelling about brands. And at the same time, we were avid consumers of the culture. Everyone was talking about, you know, at that point, the latest episode of The Sopranos, and admiring ads from Target and Apple. And there seemed to be some dissonance in how we were processing the information. And at that point, I decided to actually take a look. And I did something that turned out to be fairly radical among my colleagues, in that I decided to start from the point of view that the global justice movement and the labor movement, where I have my primary work home, and yes, even Starbucks, wanted to make the world a better place. And then I decided to go out and let everybody speak for themselves. And that's really the exploration that's followed in this book. And the first thing I did was I talked to the people I know, like Chuck, and a number of other people, including the folks at Corporate Accountability. There's a big chunk on water, actually, in this book. And what I discovered was everybody had an opinion. And if they would tell you right away, you know, oh, the company's okay about the environment, but it's lousy on fair trade. This is a company where the stores are comfortable and the product is consistent. Oh, these stores are predictable and boring. This is a harbinger of gentrification and bad for neighborhoods. This is a sign that our neighborhood is improving. And this coffee is great. This coffee sucks. So you'd get sort of that whole range of views. And, you know, one of the things that happened to me is this book is published by Rutgers. And so when I first met my publisher and the person who acquired the book for the press, she takes me out to lunch in New Brunswick. And she says to me, so how are you going to do the research for this book? And the waiter comes by with coffee, and I say, so what do you think about Starbucks? And he looks at me, and he says, they have terrible coffee, overpriced. Go to Dunkin' Donuts instead. And I turned to my publisher, and I said, so that's how I'm doing the research. And that was really kind of true. It was like, no matter what I did, whom I talked to, where I went, you could ask friends and strangers, and they'd tell you what they thought. And undoubtedly, you'll be doing the same in just a few minutes. The other thing I did is, thanks to the glories of the internet, it's actually fabulous. And first of all, there are all these sites devoted to Starbucks. IHateStarbucks.com. Starbucks gossip. So you can sort of sort through all the different opinions that people have exclusively about Starbucks. And then also there are the wonders of Google. And I love Google. And through Google Mail, you know, every day, Google would dump the articles about Starbucks right into my mailbox. And in the course of 2006, there were about 5,000 links to Starbucks articles. And it's like between 1981, when Starbucks was first mentioned in the New York Times, and the end of April 2007 or so, there were like 2,600 more, almost 2,700 references to Starbucks in the New York Times. And there were all kinds of things. I mean, the first one in 1981 wasn't even about Starbucks we know. It was about a country western disco named Starbucks. So that's the first mention of Starbucks. And then you get in, you know, 1987 or 89, you get the first mention, really, of Starbucks as we know it. So it's interesting to know this is a phenomenon of the last 20 years. And the references multiply at about the same rate, you know, relative to the stores. So by the 2006, there were like an average of one a day. You get about 300-some references to Starbucks. And I'm going to read you just a little piece that comes from the Sunday Times. This is April 22nd, 2007. And this was not unusual. So this issue of April 22nd offers a glimpse of what Starbucks has become. There are six references to the company in six different sections of the paper. Two are even about coffee. A story about Chiapas, Mexico, in the international section reports that Mr. Moshan Mendez's cooperative sells to Starbucks, which, in quotes, pays higher prices to farmers that meet its standards. Meanwhile, a fashion and style story about fair trade coffee in Brooklyn asserts that while large companies such as Starbucks now offer fair trade, the cool and the hip still eschew the chain for independent fair trade coffee houses. The travel section offers some tourist advice. Head to the Hotel Langlois if you want to experience what's left of the authentic historic Paris, the Paris with few chain stores and Starbucks. In sports, a woman tells a reporter that she grabbed the bat and chased Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter into a Starbucks for his signature because I knew that my son would love it. While in the business section, Starbucks employees report that tycoon Philip F. Anschutz arrived for work at 5 a.m. dressed in cycling clothes. He often waves to them, they say. Finally, in the book review section, we learn that change has come to Tula Springs, Louisiana. Readers familiar with St. Jude's Parish from James Wilcox's first novel, Modern Baptists, 1983, may have trouble recognizing the place today. There's a Starbucks in the Piggly Wiggly. Starbucks's progress, its hegemony, it treats farmers well. It doesn't treat them well enough. Join the stars and successful people by going there. Join the cool and politically conscious by scorning it. Brand value, as the Starbucks 10K, which is the papers that you have to file with the Security and Exchange Commission, notes, is a fragile thing. Consumer demand for the company's products, reads the 10K, and its brand equity could diminish significantly if Starbucks fails to preserve the quality of its products or behaves in a manner that is unethical or socially responsible or fails to deliver a consistently positive consumer experience. So that sort of tells you sort of all the different opinions and feelings that people had about Starbucks. And, you know, then the next thing I did, of course, is I went to the company. It's like I knew lots of people in the global justice movement. I knew lots of people in the labor movement. I knew absolutely nobody at Starbucks. And I didn't really have a regular Starbucks store, and I, you know, just went in occasionally like everybody else. And I'm a pretty lousy liar. I have one of those faces that, you know, everything I think is sort of written on my face. So I didn't really have the option of going undercover. I went directly to the company and I said, look here, I'm a labor activist. I work in the labor movement. I was in Seattle in 99, and this was like in 2004. And I'm interested in a couple of things about the company. I'm interested in corporate social responsibility. I'm interested in issues of diversity. I'm interested in unions, and so forth. And they said to me, much to my surprise, they said, okay, we'll set up some interviews. And I went to the annual meeting, which was an experience in itself, sort of like going to a Las Vegas show. It's like a big production with music and skits and film and David Letterman's top 10 lists about Starbucks and all the officers telling us how wonderful the company is. And then they set up the interviews, and those first interviews really told me that the story was going to be different than I thought. I walk into the room. There are four senior officers of the company, including the general counsel, because I had asked some questions about some union problems they were having with the Cintas Laundry Company, and the union that deals with Unite was trying to do some organizing there. I wanted to know about that, so she was there for that. Well, three of the four people in the room are African-American women. And this is all vice president and above, makes that general counsel one of the 0.003% of African women who hold that position in corporate America. And right then and there, I'm looking at this array of officers, and I'm going, this isn't what I expected. And indeed, the story turned out not to be according to the formula practically any step along the way from there on in. The company helped me when they could. You know, the reason I got in there really had to do with a single person, which is that the woman who was the head of the PR department at the time decided she was interested herself in what I was asking. Something about it struck her as interesting. She let me in the door and continued to kind of follow what I was doing and grant me access. It must be said that the company always had someone in the room with every interview that I did. There was always a monitor. When I went to the stores on official visitors, there was always a monitor from the company, although they were a little bit lax about it, in fact. And I did a lot of visits that I didn't tell them about where I didn't have a monitor to sort of try and balance that out. And then once I had done all the work with the company, I then went and talked to people right through the supply chain. I took visits to Costa Rica and to Guatemala, places where I had never been, and talked to farmers and importers and exporters, people along that chain. And then here in the States, I talked to trade unionists, people who had tried to organize the company with a lot of problems and fights, many of which are ongoing. And I also spoke to colleagues in all aspects of the global justice movement, to Oxfam, really to the range of people who interacted with the company. And I guess what I found is that Starbucks is kind of like a shapeshifter or a cross-dresser. You know, this is a company that really wants to be seen, that has kind of truly different personalities as you grow through it. This is a company that has sort of this balancing act that it's trying to perform between being profitable and being principled. And that's a very, very difficult balance to maintain in large measure because capitalism doesn't sustain that model. Under capitalism, it is required, if you're a public company, that you be profitable. While principles are kind of a suggestion, an afterthought. And therefore, there are benefits to being more profitable and less principled. And you could see this as a tension in the company throughout all the different sectors. So that you have, here's a company that has this huge desire for global product reach. You know, their early reports say, we want to be want the best-known brand in the world. You know, and they have 17,000 outlets in 49 countries. They have more than 150,000 employees. That's after all these last set of layoffs. So, so this is a big company. On the other hand, they have kind of this international vision of a global coffee culture and some genuine concerns about what happens to people along their supply chain. So you have that, and you also have this company that has this mantra about, you know, we're not anti-union, we're pro-partner. And there's lots to be said on the pro-partner side. This is actually a company that was a pioneer in offering health care for part-timers in a sector where that was virtually unheard of. And it's a big bit of business. These days, health care costs Starbucks in North America as much as their coffee beans cost them. So it's a very major commitment, and thus far, one they haven't backed off of. Although with the downturn, we're going to presumably see some changes and some pressures on that side. At the same time, there is the we're not anti-union part is highly subject to question. This is a company that definitely has behaved as an anti-union company. That's what they share with their colleagues in the corporate world. And I think it really comes down to that wherever you looked in trying to balance out profit and principle, Starbucks is also interested in maintaining power over its own decisions. And, you know, the thing that really got me, I'm going to just, Howard Schultz wrote a book called Pour Your Heart Into It way back in 1997, I think. And he says in the book, he wants workers to believe in their hearts that management trusted them and treated them with respect. I was convinced that under my leadership, employees would come to realize that I would listen to their concerns. If they have faith in me and my motives, they wouldn't need a union. And that sort of benevolent paternalism personified. And that statement really crystallized for me some about what I saw consistently, a company that frequently behaves better than average, but they want their relationships always to be individual to company. So you have individual farmer or small cooperative to the company, you know, individual worker to the company, individual consumer to the company. And once you see any collective action on any of those fronts, you begin to see the company back away from that. So that was sort of one of the consistent messages about this. And, you know, you could see it as well in Guatemala, where I went, and there was a large cooperative of cooperatives there in coffee called Fedecocagua. And they were having real problems. You know, there they were, and Starbucks has these real standards about how they want the coffee to be grown, and they have environmental standards, and they have labor standards. And those are very expensive to implement in these countries, and Fedecocagua had sort of gone through trying to implement this for all their small cooperatives, for a good section of them, and then Starbucks didn't buy their coffee in any quantity, and they were sort of left with the cost of that. And in the end, they're going like, look here, you know, we want environmental protections, we want to labor to be treated well and paid well, but in the end, we have to earn a living, and we really can't afford the burden of doing all these things if we then have no guarantee of the coffee being bought. I recently got an email from them, and they said that Starbucks had, in fact, bought a whole lot of coffee this past year, and they, I think, wrongly credited it to the book, but to the story being told in the book, but I suspect that's... I'd like to think that's true. If so, it would have made it worth it in and of itself. So I think that's part of it. I also wanted to share with you some things that this book taught me about us as progressives. I think there were some things that I started thinking about by doing the book. One is the notion that the easy targets aren't always the best targets. One of the things that really became apparent in doing this story is that people with grievances have recognized what Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, really dreads, which is that if you protest against Starbucks, your place in the morning paper is assured. And so it has become a very good target for people with grievances about these issues, without necessarily being the most strategic target. The fact is that Starbucks buys a lot of gourmet coffee, but they buy less than 5% of the world's coffee. The big coffee kings in the world are Procter & Gamble and Nestle and Kraft and Sara Lee. They together buy 60% of the world's coffee. They buy the lower grade coffee that's grown in more plantation settings at a much lower price. So I think it raised some questions for me. And, you know, as I started looking at this, I started thinking also about where we put our energies. And eventually I went, you know, water needs to be free because it's what everybody needs. Milk ought to be reasonably priced. And I really don't care how much you have to pay for a cup of coffee. It's not the critical thing. And that we often look at things very atomized and don't actually look at the spectrum of work that exists for us to do. And, you know, in the labor movement, it's been a pattern, really, that we go to the best employers and ask them to do a little better. This is a long-standing way to improve contracts. And so we would start with the employers, the companies who were the most favorable, and then try and get them to move their standards forward as a model for other companies to follow. And there's every evidence that this doesn't work very well in the global economy, that what you end up doing is disadvantaging the best companies and giving the worst companies a free ride. And when you look at Starbucks, you know, one of the things about Starbucks is partly by their own shape-shifting ways, they've sort of positioned themselves as, you know, being a relationship to your local coffee house. And that's why so many of us see them as, you know, opposition to our local coffee houses. In fact, in the marketplace, their real competition is Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's, both companies that are far, far worse than Starbucks in the way they treat both their employees and their supply chains. So it's just something for us to think about. I think the other thing is that there were sort of two pieces that really are consequences for us of having been through the Reagan era, which is that, you know, One of them has to do with the concept of the melting pot and how we feel about this. And, you know, I realize that we have grown to really disparage the concept of the melting pot. And in part, some of that's due to the fact that the Reagan era treated, you know, race and gender and issues of diversity as totally things to disparage. And, you know, everybody has an equal opportunity, blah, blah, blah. And that clearly wasn't the case. And we sort of, they put everything in terms of individual rather than systemic change. And I think what that did is it kind of hardened our ideology to counter that. And so we turned our opposition to that into kind of a hard doctrine that perhaps needs some review. There is something to be said for internationalism that smudges both physical and cultural borders. And there's, I think, something that we need to reconsider. And one of the things that this book did for me is it actually gave me a chance to do some reading. You know, being a practitioner, I spent all my years sort of doing activist work, and I haven't gotten to do a lot of this reading. So one of the things I did is I got a chance to read some of the works of philosophy Kwame Anthony Appiah, and he argues against purity, tribalism, and cultural protectionism, and suggests that cultures are made of continuities and changes, and the identity of a society can survive through those changes. Societies without change aren't authentic, they're just dead. He observes that if poor people can't afford to live in traditional ways that they treasure, that's a problem. And then he says, but if they get richer and they still run around in t-shirts, that's their choice. In this case, talk of authenticity just amounts to telling other people what they ought to value in their own traditions. And that was provocative to me, and it gave me some things to think about. I think also stemming from the Reagan era, there's this sort of question about what is in the system. And I think we came to the position that everything was systemic and that all changes have to be systemic. And, of course, I believe that, and I think that systemic change is critical. But I also found that I have some belief in personal transformation at the same time, that we don't want the political to be purely personal, but that sometimes you need personal change in the way people process information to make the big changes in society. You know, that in the end, some of what happens with green jobs will be systemic, but people also have to realize for themselves that, you know, having a big car isn't the most important thing in the world, you know. And it's sort of like Marcuse's, you know, concept that if all the worker wants is a car as big as the car the boss drives, then we've lost, and we really need that to be different. So I think that's part of it. And I think the final thing is that in my generation, at least, we learned to organize in a world that was a dichotomy. You know, it was communism versus capitalism, black versus white, good versus evil. And I think one of the things that the environmental movement has taught us that we really live in an ecosystem, not in a dichotomy. And that part of the problem is that we haven't really learned how to organize in an ecosystem. We just know how to do dichotomous organizing. It's what we were all taught. It's what I was taught, you know, and, you know, all, going all the way back to Saul Alinsky and sort of the basic principles of organizing, we've all been taught to, you know, pick a target, freeze it, make it the enemy, and go for it. And sometimes that's successful, but it also, I think, is only one and a narrow way of organizing, and that we need to try and figure out how we organize in a different kind of an environment. And in some ways, looking at this last election, I think there's at least some indication that this was not so much a dichotomous election, that some other things happened in this election, and that it's worth our while to try and think about what organizing in an ecosystem looks like. So why don't I leave it there and open it up for conversation. I didn't discuss the fair trade thing in depth because I figured there were experts in that here and it would probably come up. And we're open for discussion. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and with Starbucks, but for, I guess, 5, 6, 7 years now, we've had an ongoing campaign. A lot of our organizing has taken place in New York, some in Minnesota, some in Michigan, and recently we started setting up workers here in Boston. And it's an ongoing campaign. These are very courageous people taking on a corporation of enormous size and power that does not want its workers to be unionized. If there are any Starbucks workers here, I appreciate talking to you after the program about what we're doing here. And also, Starbucks workers are workers. They're workers like workers in, I would say, steel plants, except they're all gone. Workers, they can see every place else. And they have interests as workers. The IWW, a preamble begins, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. And this is very different from the final statements you made. But it is a dichotomous relationship. All workers have interests in common as workers, and all bosses have interests in common. And these are really opposed interests. The more they get, the less we get, and vice versa. That's pretty much it. But I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about the IWW's campaign.
I actually have quite a lot to say about the IWW, which I do in this book. There were a number of union organizing drives at Starbucks. And I have to say the one that really, is closest to my heart is the one that happened out at the roasting plant. The roasting plant near Seattle is nothing like you imagine Starbucks. It's a plant. It is a factory. Where people, as I say in the book, shovel beans the way former generations shoveled coal. And at the roasting plant, there was an argument. There were several efforts to organize the roasting plant. One early on, there was organizing that went on at Starbucks prior to Howard Schultz. And when Howard Schultz came in and made the kinds of statements that I read you, the workers at the plant decertified, the workers in Seattle decertified the union. And in the, 1999, 2000, 2001, there was an effort among the people at the roasting plant, among the engineers. What happened is they had been on a 7-day schedule, which meant that if people worked on weekends, and they had regular things, and if they worked on weekends, they got overtime pay. And the company decided that wasn't really sensible and that everybody should work a 40-hour week. And they, have their 5 days on or off, and no one would get overtime pay for weekends. And the people who were the engineers at the factory, 22 people, in a factory of 300, decided to go organize with the operating engineers. And the company did everything they could basically to break the union. You know, this was my least favorite story in all the research I did. And one of the things they did is they went to the Human Resources Department and they said, don't hire anyone who has ever had any union experience, no one who's ever belonged to a union, et cetera. And this is Seattle, home of Boeing, you know, a pretty decent union town. And one of the women in the Human Resources Department said, sorry, that's against the law. I'm not going to do it. And they fired her. And she went to the Labor Relations Board. And the company eventually settled for a very substantial amount of money. And eventually they sort of, the 22 guys who had joined the union one by one sort of were harassed into leaving. And in the end, there was nobody left, two people left who had belonged to that bargaining unit, and it was over. That being said, and I'm going to come to the IWW thing in this context as well. That being said, this story, in no way to excuse the company, also tells us something about the labor movement at the same time as it tells us something about the company, which is that if you have a plant of 300 people and you organize 22 people in the plant, your chances of sustaining that are not great. Furthermore, and this I do not say in the book, it's the one place where I kind of pulled my punches, those 22 guys, of course, were mostly the white male skilled people in the plant, in a plant that was hugely racially and gender diverse. Those are issues about organizing in the labor movement, and they tell us something about, you know, this is where I spend my life and something I care about, but it also tells us something about how we need to look at our organizing. In the case of the IWW, one of the things I found in talking with workers around the country is that very few workers around the country had heard about the union, and even fewer had heard from them. That the people doing the organizing tended to be white, frequently middle class, occasionally upper middle class. The workers tended to be, again, hugely diverse. And it was an issue. And so workers would tell me, you know, and I talked to a lot of different workers, both in urban and rural areas. In rural areas, they simply hadn't heard anything about the organizing campaign. But even in urban areas like D.C., where people had sometimes heard about the campaign and sometimes even agreed with some of the issues that were raised, particularly around hours, they would say, they were offended by the tactics and the culture that came with that organizing. And, you know, I had sort of this experience of going to one of the IWW demonstrations in New York. And there was a group, and it was during the Republican convention in New York in 2004, and there was a big demonstration, and there were maybe 200 people in the demonstration, almost all white, heavily male, outside the store, a store full of workers of color. And there's something wrong with that. You know, there's a problem with that. And I think that we need to just be reflective and thoughtful about the way we do our organizing and what the culture of our organizing says. So I think that it's a, you know, on the other hand, there are things clearly that the Wobblies have captured. One of the things is that in this day and age, the notion that we can organize just at one workplace, you know, and that the union membership is tied to a workplace is probably outdated. People move around much more. Their relationship to work is really different, and we probably need to look at some different ways of organizing in the global community that create a union membership that is not tied so specifically to a single employer. And I think the other thing is that culture is important in doing our organizing, that we have to build a different kind of collective culture. And one of the things that startled me all the time as I went to talk with workers, and particularly young workers, was that collective action was not something on the top of their agenda. I was startled by how many of the workers I spoke to wanted to be entrepreneurs. That advancement was seen as a very individual thing. And so, you know, for us in the labor movement, I think part of what our challenge is to rethink and talk about how we create a collective presence for working people, something desperately needed if we're going to have a voice at all in the global economy. Any other questions, thoughts? Pardon? Well, you know, it's like, it's really hard to write. I used to say doing this book that the two hardest things for me in this book was there's a chapter on working called When Worker Met Partner, which is what Starbucks calls its workers. And there are other euphemisms for worker through it. That sort of deals with organizing and the culture of organizing. And then there's a chapter called Capitalism is Like Fire, which deals with capitalism and sort of rethinking that. And, you know, it was really hard to write the labor chapter because I love labor despite its faults, and hard to write the capitalism chapter because I hate capitalism despite its virtues. And that both those things were hard to do, you know, and it's like... But it was well worth thinking about. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how to ask this question. One of the reasons that I think Starbucks is not popular with some of us is that, you know, rather than having, you know, the mom and pop coffee and donut shop, you know, there was one that used to exist in Central Square. In Cambridge, I remember in the old days, and there's a Starbucks there now. And, you know, it's very visible. They're, like, on every corner. And, you know, some of us saw the film about Reverend Billy a number of months ago here. And he kind of goes after Starbucks because it's kind of like it's not like a real culture. You know, you go in there and it kind of has this bohemian kind of feel. I don't know. I mean, I don't go into Starbucks, so I don't know. But I would hope that Starbucks would be doing something to support the communities of which it's such a visible part. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah. You know, in some ways I found the cultural piece of this complex for many reasons. I'm one of those people who always tries to go to an independent if there's one around. I'm endlessly curious about the range of independents, and I like them, you know, and I like our local independent as well. There were two things that were different to me that I discovered and thought about in doing the book and that I came to think about more. One is that we have sort of this love affair with the notion of mom and pops, which means that we've created sort of an ethos around them that is worth taking another look at for the following reasons. One is that while everyone has the anecdotal story about, oh, Starbucks moved in and the local independent closed, the numbers actually do not bear that out. In fact, there are more independents today than there were. So, I mean, I actually, somewhere in here, this is sort of one of these tricky questions, you know? But I have my little crib sheet here. So in 1998, There were 7,500 independents and 2,000 Starbucks. Okay? In 2005, there were 14,000 independents and 7,000 Starbucks. Starbucks keeps on getting more and more of the market share, but there are also more and more independents. Turns out that Starbucks sort of created a market for something that wasn't there before. And so that's one piece of it. And frequently, the independents do very well. That is, Starbucks did fine, and the independents did fine, too. And so it was a slightly different narrative from the one that I thought before I did the research and that most of my friends and colleagues also shared. The other thing really has to do with that whole question about what an independent is and how it functions. And, you know, over the course of the book, my folks live in Pittsburgh, and I, you know, so I did interviewed a bunch of folks at independents in Pittsburgh and in various other ones I went to. So in Pittsburgh, at my favorite one called the 61C, named for the bus line that goes by its door. Kate Knorr owns that, and, you know, she opened this up. It's a labor of love. It's a successful independent coffee house. The coffee house is a living enterprise for, it has 1.5 permanent staff people and then a range of part-timers. They get paid just over minimum wage, but less than the Starbucks workers. They have no benefits. And so a young woman there who's worked on and off there, she says, the way I feel about my employers here is much more important to me than having health care. And that's a real position of privilege. I mean, to be able to make that statement is a very tricky bit of business. And, you know, I went to this independent in upstate New York after the book was done, and there's this tip jar standing on the thing, and it says, you know, put in a tip so that Susie can go to the dentist. And I'm like, I don't think so. You know, it's like we forget that the big advances for workers and working people were actually made in big workplaces, not at mom and pops, that small enterprises don't have room for advancement. For example, you know, there's no place to move up, and they very seldom have benefits. Large numbers of independents could give two figs about fair trade. You know, fair trade may only be 5% of what Starbucks buys, but they pay for the rest of their coffee at more or less fair trade prices, and they're still the largest purchaser of fair trade coffee in North America. So I think it's a complicated story. And when it came to who worked at the stores, the independents were almost all white and frequently, you know, college students, and while there are plenty of people at Starbucks who also fit that description, there are lots of other people working at Starbucks as well. And I think we need to evaluate that. We need to sort of throw that into the hopper as well. And in the end, you know, I found that more complicated to dissect. And I began to think, well, you know, I may be paying $4 for this cup of coffee, but at least I know that the folks here can get health care. And that was important to me. So I think those are some of the things just to factor in. I like to say that just like in the coffee fields, I like to have an ecosystem in my urban environment as well. And that Starbucks has been maybe a little less interested in the ecosystem in our urban areas than it has been in the coffee fields. And they are predatory in terms of their real estate dealings, primarily. Being that big means you can pay a lot more rent than the independent. And that's really where you begin to see some of the complexities that come along as the rents in an area go up. You know, if Starbucks wants a corner, they can afford to pay more than the local independent. And that's where there are economies of scale and power that do come into the mix, and I think that's where it's problematic. They do pretty well they do a lot of local charitable work in many of the communities where they are. They do that. I ultimately decided charitable works were not my assessment of goodness. I really, you know, lots of people, it's hard to be against, you know, reading programs for children. I actually began to evaluate goodness as, you know, how you use your power in your sphere of influence, which actually was the definition that Marshall Gantz, who teaches here at Harvard, provided. And I liked that, how you treat the people and issues with which you come in contact, over which you have power, in the course of doing business. And I think that's a more important measure of goodness than your charitable work, of which they do quite a bit. Yeah, hi.
Yo trabajé como un cogedor de café en Costa Rica por 16 años. Mm-hmm. I worked in Costa Rica as a coffee picker for many years. It was a very enjoyable job in the sense that you work a calle, they give you a row to work, and you can work with your wife on the other side of the row or a friend, you can discuss. Can you imagine sitting down with someone and talking with a friend or a relative for 6 or 7 hours a day? You know, trading recipes, talking about a sporting event, because all you use is your hands. What I didn't like was that the mountain range was owned by Calderon, who was the president of Costa Rica, and the oligarchy was at the top. And after picking coffee for 6 or 7 or 8 hours, you have to stand in line and you get paid these tokens that you can use at the local store. And you might make, if you're good, $3 a day. If you're real good, $4 a day. If you're not very good, $2 a day. It depends on how much coffee you pick and the quality of the coffee you pick. Because if you have too many green, they're not beans, they're fruit. Coffee is a fruit. The coffee fruit has a seed in it that we call a bean, but it's a seed. And while you're picking coffee, you can throw a few in your mouth and eat them, and they taste like a pear or an apple, sort of a combination. But what I thought was not real good was that when you're making, let's say, $3 or $4 a day, if you could speak English, you could make $100 a day. If you worked in an office, you might make $20, $30, $40, $50 a day. And so if you got $4 a day or even $5 a day because you got paid better than what you used to get paid, you're still going to be living on a tin shack with an outhouse in the back. And that even under the best of conditions, the coffee pickers who were making the most money still were making maybe a tenth. And so the differences between the poor and the rich were growing enormously with global free trade and globalization. And I thought the disparity between the poor and the rich was very unhealthy for the country as a whole.
I think that's really true. Farm workers and pickers are always at the bottom of the economic hierarchies and struggle mightily. I think it probably fell out of the book. I talk about some of that in the book, but the piece that fell out in the other piece in Costa Rica particularly is that Costa Rica also imports Nicaraguans from across the border to pick coffee. And they speak about the Nicaraguans exactly the way people here speak about Mexican labor. The Nicas. The Nicas were responsible for all crime, everything going wrong in Costa Rican society, wherever you went. And I think this remains a serious problem. I think that it's a very correct observation.
Another thing that bothered me was that they were cutting down the virgin forest for coffee fields and then saying, let's be ecologically sustainable, growing coffee and not fumigate and insecticide. And it was just a contradiction of terms.
Yeah. It varies a little bit on the kind of coffee you pick. In fact, the kind of coffee that Starbucks uses, there's sort of two kinds of coffee. There's Robusta and there's Arabica. And they're the Robusta. Think of it sort of like a caste system for coffee. The lower on the mountain you grow, the cheaper the coffee, and the less desirable. Gourmet coffee grows higher up in altitude and tends to grow on smaller farms and actually needs a good ecosystem and shade to grow well and to be good coffee. So that has somewhat benefited. One of the stories in here, which was sort of an accidental, a story that I hadn't expected, was there's a sort of that when Nestle and Procter & Gamble were sort of the only coffee growers, they wanted the coffee to be cheap and easily picked. And so they really did demand that people cut down their trees so that they could, so that the sun would ripen the beans faster and they could be picked easier and cheaper. And with the advent of gourmet coffee, there actually became an economic reason to permit the trees to stand and to reforest some of the areas. And you see that happen. And one of the sort of things that happened when I went to some of these places, I would say, you know, eventually I was going, people were very grateful to Starbucks in both Costa Rica and Guatemala, although more cynical in Guatemala even than in Costa Rica. But what happened was, you know, the World Bank had this sort of idea that Vietnam should become a coffee-growing country. So, you know, 98, 99, 2000, suddenly Vietnam grows all this cheap coffee and it comes onto the market and the price of coffee plummets. You know, it goes from over a dollar to 50 cents. And farmers are losing their farms left and right. And Starbucks takes a look around and they say, you know, if this goes on, we're not going to have any suppliers left. Even though they don't buy the cheap coffee, all that cheap coffee ends up depressing all the coffee prices. And so they go, you know, this goes on, we're not going to have any suppliers. And they decide not to follow the market down. This was other than the healthcare, the one systemic thing they did that was really significant. And instead they offer their suppliers multi-year contracts at 2 and 3 times the rate that was being paid on the coffee exchange. And because of that, a lot of small farmers survive. And people all over the region would say, you know, I wouldn't be here today if Starbucks hadn't done that. And they had a sufficient amount of the gourmet coffee bean market that by doing that, they forced anyone else who wanted to buy gourmet beans to have to pay higher prices as well. They sort of set an artificial floor under the cost of good coffee. And that made a real systemic difference to people, and they remember that. They are perfectly aware that Starbucks gets rich while they just get by, but they're getting by. And they credit Starbucks with that. So, you know, that was the good story. And so I kept on going, oh, tell me something bad about this company. Please tell me something bad about this company. And finally, so I go visit one of these co-ops, and this guy says, bad, I'll tell you what's bad. They make you do all this stuff. in order to certify the beans, and they make they clean up the stream, and they make you stop use pesticides, and they make you use different fertilizer, and they make you grow these trees, and then they make you document it all. And everywhere I went, people pulled out their books and said, look at all this paper we have to fill out. Starbucks makes us fill out all this paper to prove we've done all this stuff, and we really hate it. And then he shrugged, and he said, well, so for the first 2 or 3 years, it's really bad, but then it's great, he says, you know, and then you get the benefit of it, and it's great. But it was sort of an interesting story that sort of, by accident, in some ways, Starbucks had become like this certifier of ecosystem improvement. And I found that somewhat surprising and entertaining. Yeah?
I think Dunkin' Donuts had investments from the Carlyle Group, that sort of thing. What are the investment patterns for Starbucks like?
You know, off the top of my head, I don't know the answer to that this second. Starbucks still, a lot of the Starbucks stock is still owned by Schultz and Company. And it seems to be pretty dispersed. And there was some discussion about a year or two ago, actually with hedge funds buying up some of the stock. But I don't know that they're holding it anymore.
Did they share?
Pardon?
Did they share with the employees at all?
Yes, they do. With the employees, yes. Of course, these days there's not that much profit to share. Starbucks is having a rough time just like everybody else these days. And so I think that is a pressure on the benefits. I mean, it's one of those arguments that when you have a corporation and no countervailing force and their profits are under stress, the benefits to the employees suffer. So you get these sort of peculiar things happening, like there was one week in the last, you know, couple of months where first it's announced that they just got a $50 million new jet, corporate jet, just like the auto industry. It's just about the same week that they announced that they couldn't afford to pay in the company part of the 401k plans anymore, you know. So that's kind of dim-witted. And sometimes they just do something plain stupid like that, and you wonder who was thinking about this. On the other hand, Howard Schultz said that he was only going to be paid $10,000 this year. So that's at least an acknowledgement. Well, I'm going to have to see what it actually says. I haven't seen the fine print yet. That just came out like in the last 2 or 3 days. But I am curious to see what part of the package he gets to keep. Yeah.
What has Starbucks' response or reaction to your publication?
Starbucks has really not talked to me since the book came out. One of the things, I talk about this in the book, you know, Howard Schultz has this mantra about being able to grow big while you stay small and intimate at the same time. And I think that's an incredibly hard thing to do. And as the company became bigger, the nature of the people they hired changed as well. And over time, you sort of see the kind of quirky people, like the woman who let me in the first place, and you know, some of the people I talk to leaving. And the new people who come in are much more corporate speaky, much less quirky than the people they replaced. And if I were starting this book today, I am pretty sure that there would be no one to give me the access that I had when I started the book. I personally, of course, think they should be grateful to me because I treated them ever so much better than than many of my colleagues think I should have, but not well enough for them. I mean, I have a serious critique, obviously, about how they interact with unions and their sort of, arrogance and need for maintaining power and control. And so, not good enough to warrant an anything. They haven't answered a single question of mine that I've asked since the book came out in August or September. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
I'm curious why Starbucks seems to be a lightning rod. You imply that protests at Starbucks are coming to the newspaper. I don't recall that happening at McDonald's or Dunkin' Donuts. So Louis Black did a whole routine on Starbucks. Why do they attract more attention than other companies?
I think it's because they are so omnipresent. I mean, one of the things is that, as Howard Schultz says to me, it's much easier to picket a Starbucks store and much more dramatic than to go into the supermarket and squish a can of Coca-Cola. And I think that's true. It's, when you think about targeting that became Corporate Accountability International is one of few companies that actually did target Nestle, targeted a great big target like that and made it stick. But it is harder to do, and I think many protesters go for an easier, quicker fix. I also think that it was sort of a set of things that came together. It sort of stood at the intersection of both global issues and local issues and people who are concerned about culture. And the fact that all of those came together created kind of a nexus of interest. And the third thing is that, unlike others, Starbucks in some ways has marketed its goodness. And once you draw attention to how good you are, there is, of course, an interest in checking out whether you really are that good. And it's hard to live up to that. And it's hard to consistently live up to it. And then your missteps become magnified. And I think all those play into why Starbucks has become the kind of lightning rod it has. And also, just like that sort of piece from the Times indicated, it has become more than itself. Of those six articles, only two were about coffee, and all the rest were cultural. It has become a stand-in. And there are a startling number of, for instance, stories today written about, Starbucks and the economy, what Starbucks tells you about the economy. It's sort of become a symbol for a lot of other things, a metaphor for a certain kind of consumption. And for those reasons, it has an added power to it. Yeah?
You mentioned fair trade earlier, and there's a lot of criticisms towards Starbucks in relation to fair trade that, maybe they could be buying more. And you said they do, in fact, buy the most in the U.S., and that's very impressive. But what are the answers from Starbucks on either side of the argument about that criticism, whether or not they could be buying more, and if they're negatively influencing the criteria of fair trade, that's not really benefiting social change?
Well, I think there are two things about the fair trade. I think the fair trade thing is really interesting, and it's one of the things that I really try to sort of work through in trying to figure out. One of the questions I keep on asking in this book is, can you be big and good at the same time? How big, how good, and how do we know what makes something good? And there's sort of two different standards of goodness. There's sort of a relative goodness and an absolute goodness. And you sort of have to decide how good is good enough. And, there was no question in my mind that Starbucks was better than most corporations. Is that good enough? It depends, on how you want to parse that. I think you are correct. I found that the issue with the fair trade was not price. Most often, Starbucks matches fair trade prices, even if it isn't fair trade coffee. They do not try to pay the absolute cheapest possible. As one of the people said, we don't try to wring the last penny out of our supply chain. And generally, I found that to be true. However, you know, what goes along with fair trade is a philosophy about bringing power to cooperatives, you know, about creating more power, leaving more money, you know, fewer steps in the supply chain, all of those kinds of issues. And I think that those aren't Starbucks' primary interests. Starbucks' primary interest is quality. They only buy, that's their first screen, is quality. The beans have to be good enough. And, you know, their constant discussion about fair trade is there's not enough quality fair trade coffee for us to buy that much more fair trade coffee. So they keep on, as the quality of fair trade coffee goes up, which it has, they also buy more fair trade coffee. Could they buy more? Probably. But they, just like many of the small artisanal roasters, are choosing to create their own relationships with farmers and cooperatives. And I had plenty of smaller roasters who also said to me, I don't like dealing with the fair trade people. I want to have personal relationships with with individual farmers or small cooperatives. And they also didn't have much use for the larger cooperatives. And I found that problematic both at Starbucks and at some of the artisanal roasters equally, I guess. But when you talk to farmers across the board, most of them say that fair trade is probably the one certification that has benefited them the most at all sectors of the supply chain. And they're grateful for Starbucks, but they also understand the difference. And, you know, one of the things about Fedecocagua in Guatemala is, you know, they build. They're a really big cooperative of cooperatives. A lot of the artisanal roasters I talked to said, oh, we don't like dealing with these big collections of cooperatives because they're less transparent, less money goes to the individual farmers, et cetera, et cetera. But the truth is, that's what collective action is, that some of that money goes to creating collective power. And Fedecocagua has managed to, you know, get, for the first time, some indigenous small growers onto the board of onto the National Coffee Board and elect some people to office. And that's really important. And that's the kind of stuff that Starbucks and corporations are not going to do. And so I think those are, you know, again, some things to kind of look at and explore. You had your hand up before. And then I'll come back this way. You. You.
I was just wondering if there's anything positive
to be said about I didn't actually find very much. The positive to be said about Dunkin' Donuts is that all their espresso drinks are made with fair trade coffee as well. They do purchase a fair trade that's significant. Other than that, not so much. And the other thing about Dunkin' Donuts is, unlike Starbucks, Starbucks doesn't franchise exactly. They own most of their freestanding stores themselves. They are centralized. While Dunkin' Donuts is a franchise operation, which means that the individual owners get to decide a lot more about the individual stores and therefore the standards and healthcare and stuff are not up to snuff. This guy has had his hand up a long time, and then you in the orange hat. You. So.
Well, I work with Phyllis.
Oh.
Well, I mean, I love to make Starbucks. so just like, maybe steer a little bit of that. But I did want to ask you said
earlier, I think it's an interesting point that capitalism discourages principles.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's, I mean, almost dead on, but like, worst misperception of consumers and businesses, like, capitalism definitely rewards principles, how, you know, fair trade exists, and, you know, Starbucks definitely capitalized on that for a very long time. I'm just wondering, like, from your perspective, like, what is that watershed when people sort of turn on you for not doing everything that you could be doing? And I think, to this guy's question, you could be here in 5 years talking about Whole Foods, how to bet money. You could be here in 5 years talking about Whole Foods. But also just from a labor perspective, like, to what degree do you have any faith in consumers pushing forward this agenda, or is it sort of, like, what's it now, where are things going, like, is that a segment of that population that cares enough to go with their dog without getting bigger, or are they just passing through these various stages and reacting to that?
Tough question. I think it's going to be hard to get consumers to care enough. That seems to be the general, you know, if, when in the polling it talks about it here, people say they care enough, but when it comes to their purchasing habits, it isn't clear that that's what gets followed in practice. So there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect. And some of that also has to do with how affordable we make it to change people's consumption habits. At the moment, as Whole Foods is a perfect example, you want organic produce, you're going to pay more for it than you pay for your chemicaled produce. And so it becomes very difficult for lower income people to actually do the right kinds of purchasing. The Whole Foods question is interesting for another. I actually would, when it comes to companies with which one has problems, I actually find Whole Foods a lot more reprehensible because they have blatant anti-unionism as part of their creed. You know, Schultz doesn't quite have it as part of his creed in the same way, although the results are sometimes the same. On the other hand, like many, you know, there are many, many corporations that actually turn their issues into political capital. And so far, Starbucks really has not done that. They do not have a PAC. They do not spend their money to fight minimum wage, a number of other things like that that are actually significant. And I hope that remains that way. I'm thinking the Employee Free Choice Act may be the moment where we see where Starbucks really sits on this question. You know, but thus far, they have actually refrained from turning their, you know, corporate policies into political muscle. And so far, so good. I'd rather that they lobby for universal health care, which would definitely be in their interest. But it's a tricky one, you know. I don't know. And I'm thinking that for consumers to really change the way, for us to really change the way we consume, requires a real reorientation. I think it's one of those next frontiers along with nationalism, things we haven't really come to grips with yet, but have to if we really want the world to be a different and survivable place. Yeah, you have the last question.
Do you know what percentage of the beans in a package must be fair trade certified in order for it to be labeled fair trade?
I think I'm going to turn that right over to Equal Exchange. I think it's in here some way, but I can't remember for the life of me. So,
in all of it.
I think that's true, yeah. And, yeah, that's good.
Decisively answer questions. All
right. Yes.
All right. Let's thank Kim for coming out.
Thank you. I had so much fun.
I can indulge you for just one more minute before you leave. We're selling Kim's book at a discount tonight. You heard how thoughtful and reflective her, and that's really what the tone of this book is. So if you have a favorite coffee drinker that you'd like to buy a book and have Kim inscribe it, think about that. So, and I wanted to let you know that Friday, we have another Jamaica Plain forum here, a report from Bolivia. It's going to be a terrific forum. It's here at 7 o'clock. One thing that I just wanted to mention is First Church has a food pantry. We have people come to our door who are hungry, and our food pantry is almost empty, and it's a reflection of the times. And one of the things that Jamaica Plain Forum is going to start to do is, as part of forums, we'll be collecting food for the food pantry here. So if you think about, you're coming to a Jamaica Plain Forum, think food pantry.
Thank you.
And finally, I want to thank David Goodman, who recorded tonight and has a terrific program on Sunday mornings on MBR. And starting in the next week or two, you're going to be able to download MP3 files with our Jamaica Plain Forum talks, thanks to David and our web designers. So, again, thanks to Kim. And if you could, in the KP4 tradition, put your chair away on one of the racks, help us close up for the evening. And please, though, feel free to linger, talk to Kim, and buy a book. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Bienvenido.